This is Popular Front, a podcast focused on the niche details of modern warfare and underreported conflict with me, Jake Hanrahan. Today we're speaking to journalist Danny Gold. He's going to be talking to us about his recent trip to the front lines in the Donbass in East Ukraine, an area that is being absolutely smashed right now by Russian forces. Unfortunately, a lot of the Ukraine conflict is slowly slipping out the news, but Danny's been there. He's going to tell us what's actually happening in the East, how the situation is amongst the soldiers there. If you like what we're doing here at Popular Front, please consider supporting us at patreon.com/popularfront or popularfront.co/support. So you've very recently just got back from a long trip reporting in Ukraine. You spent quite a bit of time in the Donbass, particularly in some very hot areas. Just firstly, give us an idea of like what the status is, at least in the areas you were in, like where you were. Like, give us an idea of what it's like at the minute, because I think people are getting a slightly warped perception at the moment through social media as opposed to actual listening to reporters like yourself who were actually there. So yeah, give us an idea. What was it like?
Yeah, you know, I bounced around a bit, and when I was in Kharkiv, it was kind of a very optimistic situation, right? The Ukrainian forces had recently pushed the Russians back significantly to a situation where the city itself wasn't being shelled that much. I mean, the especially the outskirts of Kharkiv were hit really, really hard for a long period of time. It was quite terrifying. And I was kind of there maybe like a month and a half ago when they were liberating these areas and pushing them back. And I think they were able, the Russians came back a little bit more and then were pushed back again. But it was very optimistic. And in the East, it's a very different situation, right? The situation in the Donbass is it's really intense. I mean, we are talking extremely high level, high intensity artillery battles that are ongoing, continuous, day after day after day. And you know, it's a hard thing to wrap your head around, right? And I'm not a military strategist, right? I'm not one of these guys who knows every single battle move. I don't look at a piece of equipment and know exactly what that piece of equipment is, right? But I've covered a lot of wars. And I can't ID it. You know, I don't know the range for certain pieces of artillery and all that stuff, but I've covered a lot of wars and I like to think I'm good. You know, I had this joke with Nathan Russer, who does all the maps really well about vibes in, you know, just getting a feeling for the situation and that sort of thing, which isn't obviously the most accurate way to do things, but it's hard to wrap your head around, right? Because the situation there is really, really intense. And the Russians, you know, they have the Ukrainians completely outnumbered. They have them outarmed. They have a lot more heavy equipment. They have a lot more range with their artillery, and they're hitting them very hard, but they're only making incremental progress, right? They're inching forward. It's new tactics as well, because they're not going with these rapid advances anymore. They're just obliterating places and moving forward, but they still haven't taken Severodonetsk, right? And this has been what, a month and a half. That's a city of 100,000 people. It's not really that significant. You know, it's on lower ground next to Lysychansk and all that, but it is taking them a while, but they are making progress. And both sides are losing a tremendous amount of men, tremendous amount of firepower every day, right? So the Ukrainians are taking heavy losses, as are the Russians. But the Russians aren't advancing to a degree where I think it's something that you can look at and be like, wow, they're doing amazing, or they've completely changed everything and now they're going to win this war, right? They've already kind of lost what their intentions were in the first place, which were to sort of decapitate the government in Kiev and sort of turn Ukraine to a vassal state. They're not going to be able to do that anymore. No. But the East is definitely under threat, and it's definitely bad there. Like, there's a lot of, just so much firepower, and the Ukrainians are taking losses, and they've started to admit those losses in recent weeks, you know, up to 100 guys a day being killed. Some numbers said 200. It's a hard thing to parse too, because part of you is kind of like, well, you know, maybe this is another part of propaganda where you're saying how bad things are to encourage Western nations to donate. Right.
Yeah.
So it's hard to, I think, really suss that out. All I can say is that it is very, very intense, and it's not a good situation.
Well, yeah, this is the reality. I mean, I've spoken about this with some people, and they're like, oh, don't be like a Russian propaganda. It's like, bro, it's just real life. Like, it's just the reality on the ground. I mean, for anyone, if anyone, like, if you're helping someone by actually giving the real information, it's the fucking guys on the ground fighting. Like, they need to know. Like, people I've spoke to are like, hey, like, we don't have the right weapons here. We haven't got this. The chain of command is fucked. Like, you know, they're the people that want to, you know, they kind of want that information out there. Who was it you were with? Like, which unit were you with? Do you know? Was it just like volunteers or?
Well, I would also add that too, though. But it's also like, you know, you get some on the other side too that are just like completely doomerism. Like, you know, they're going to lose Slovyansk, right? Like, and it's imminent, all that. And I don't think that's true either, right? I think
I agree. Yeah. Somewhere in the middle.
I bounced around with a bunch of units. I mean, in Donbass, we did like an overnight with a unit that was just south of, what was it? Hold on one sec. Where? I mean, you know, we were all over the place. Just kind of like one of those situations where you wake up in the morning, you check what happened last night, you jump in the car with a guy who barely speaks English, and you just drive around to the various areas that are, you know, not the fronts, but second line positions, things like that, and kind of see where you can get in and what you can do. And then you get turned back and you try a side road and you do all that, you know, or you stop on the side of the road and there'll be soldiers there. We'd come up on soldiers a couple of times that were just kind of like, you know, taking a break under trees next to the road because they had just come back from a frontline position and they were just getting like rest for a little bit because they'd been in intense situations for 3 or 4 days. And you just kind of start talking to people and figure it out. They're pretty cagey these days about revealing their units and things like that. We did that overnight that was south. It wasn't south of Liman. I'm trying to remember exactly where it was. But it's a group that I think has had a, you know, we got there and we were all psyched about this access that we got because we were going to spend the night there and all that. And then it turns out those guys had spoke to like a bunch of people and had a bunch of people in there with them in the ensuing days. So that's always fun, you know. Actually, no, it was south of Liman in that area, which was a group. I think, I'm not even sure. They told us they had some reconnaissance units there. It was a second line position where people that were, they did rotations where they'd be at the front for 3 days, then they'd come back out for 3 days. So there were some people there who were actively going in there. You know, there were marksmen, there were snipers that were going in there every day. And there were others, I think, who were just kind of like more on the back lines, maybe artillery and things like that. But it was, while we were there, it was supposed to be a quiet area. And it was still like the mortars that were coming in, the shells that were coming in, were close enough that we could hear them whistling, you know, and that like when the outgoing was going, it would shake the little bunker that we were in.
What was the morale like of the lads you were with?
It goes both ways. You know, we'd meet people like the one coffee shop we'd be there and we were talking to some guys who were, you know, just like, look, we want to keep fighting. Like, we're here to do this. We're not giving up. But unless they give us weapons, like we're going to be screwed. You know, like every day, I think the line was something along the lines of like, every day they delay these heavier weapon shipments. It's not just the debate to us. Every day we're losing, you know, 50 more guys while they like dilly-dally about giving, and they being European countries and the US about giving us more stuff. So people are definitely aware of the realism, how hard it is. You know, I don't think we met anyone who was looking to desert or who was super, super just like everything's going to fall. This is a disaster. But we met people who were very frustrated at times, who were aware of how dark the situation was. At the same time, the morale, the fight is still there, right? No one we met was ready to give up or was ready like to give the Russians anything. They still want to take back. They weren't just talking February 24th lines, right? They were take everything. They want to take it back. So it's another one of those things too, where there's no like, there's no like easy answer, like it's great, you know, or like it's terrible. It's a mixture of both because the people that were on the front lines are aware of how grueling the fighting is, while at the same time, you know, they think that the Ukrainian army is capable of taking these things back and like, you know, stopping the Russians and pushing them backwards.
Right. And in what kind of fighting was actually taking place? Like what was because obviously from what I've been seeing, it's just like a lot of Russians just peppering day and night with artillery. And then you got ground troops, like, you know, Ukrainians there. What was that like? What were you seeing?
First of all, you know, we didn't get to like frontline. I don't think any journalists really have.
No, right. But it's, you know, you're in the dump. You're about as close as you can get.
Yeah. Right. We're at second line positions, things like that. It's artillery duels. You know, it is artillery versus artillery. A lot of the guys we spoke to were seeing, they've never seen Russians, you know? They've it's just artillery battles from kilometers away is mostly what it is. And then they were saying, you know, east of the river, they were being hit by airstrikes, helicopters, things like that. Obviously, there are people that are going and doing recon, that are spotting, that are doing stuff back. if you look at the videos that are coming out of Severodonetsk, that is like urban battling right there. You know, that is house to house, room to room, guns blazing, RPGs, all that sort of stuff. It's very intense. But I think the majority of it is artillery battles. Overwhelmingly, that's what troops are seeing. You know, that's what they're dealing with. We had, you know, the guys that we did the overnight with, they were a couple situations where they were like, you know, we have had Russian groups, 12, 20 men, try to make incursions. But I think they said it was maybe two or three times that happened. For the most part, it's artillery battles, maybe recon groups getting into some heavy stuff. And then drones are such a big part of it, man. And I'm not even talking about like Bayraktars or anything like that. Like DJI consumer drones. Yeah, consumer drones, Mavics, things like that, that are going out there and being used to spot and recalibrate and do stuff like that. Like that's a constant thing that people are either using or that they're concerned with. And a constant request for equipment is newer high level drones, thermal drones, you know, ones that can show heat sensors, things like that. Those are like the number one request for equipment that you hear from Ukrainian soldiers.
In terms of the level of combat deaths and what have you, do you have any kind of idea of what roughly might be the reality right now in the Donbass?
I mean, you know, the numbers that they're saying, 60 to 100, seem like they could be accurate. We didn't stop by any hospitals or really see things like that, but you would speak to some people who were like talking about their units, how they lost like four or five men, and there's lots of rumors flying around too, where people just getting messages from other people in other areas talking about how this unit got decimated by artillery, this one got hit. Like from what I can gather, I think that 100 number sounds like it's probably accurate. That's 60 to 100 deaths, I think, with a couple of hundred casualties as well added to that every day.
In terms of like, so obviously there are kind of like these social media commentators. The vast majority are not in the Donbass, haven't been to the Donbass. Many haven't even been to Ukraine. There's a lot of what we were saying before. It's like kind of copium. And I get it. You know, it's, you know, there's an invading country has just invaded a sovereign nation and within the first 3 months committed unbelievable massacres, Bucha, Irpin, Mariupol, whatever. But there is like a, I think, quite a disconnect between the coverage of the kind of social media commentator watchdog world versus people like yourself, reporters on the ground. What do you think is the kind of biggest disparity or like biggest kind of, you know, thing that is just not right that's going out there?
You know, it's hard to say, right? Because the narrative along this story has changed frequently. You know, in the lead up to the invasion, there were a lot of people who didn't think the invasion would happen. And that was sort of the thing that was going. And then once it started, the whole narrative was that the Ukrainians were going to get decimated, right? It was going to be over in a matter of days or weeks. So when you had this pushback, I think that was for all intents and purposes, like really impressive, you know, like an astounding victory on the Ukrainian part to defend Kiev, to defend Kharkiv, to push the Russians out of a lot of areas. I think it's kind of natural that people are going to, and you see this with journalists too, and not just this story, but other stories, whether it's, you know, Kurds, Palestinians, all that. Journalists, I think, are drawn to, and people that pay attention to this stuff are drawn to underdog stories, right? Mm-hmm. So I think in general, it's easy to get swept up in that. And I've been swept up in that as well, you know, at times. And for a while, the momentum really was with Ukraine making gains every single day, pushing the Russians out. So I think that is an easy thing for people to fall into, right? Especially because it is the story of them fighting off it's a war of survival for them, you know. Absolutely, a war of extermination. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I get it. You know, I understand why that's happening. I think corrections to what's happening are being made as the war kind of stalemates in a way. Not stalemates, but becomes more static, I think, along the lines that it's in right now. And that the sort of pronouncements from the Ukrainian intel and military and people in charge have gotten a bit more dire and a bit more, you know, admissions of concern, admissions of losses and things like that. But, you know, the narrative has changed significantly, I think, at various points of this contest, Jesus Christ, edit that out, man, has at various points of this conflict, this war. And it's kind of, at the same time, you have Russians who are pro-Russian people who are trying to convince you that like Kiev was a feint and Kharkiv was a feint, which is nonsense. You don't lose, you know, over 1,000 vehicles and hundreds of tanks and tens of thousands of men for a feint. That's, and generals as well. So yeah, it's like you said, man, there's a lot of I think nonsense floating around. I understand some of it to a degree, But even on the ground, you know, it's not an easy thing to parse what's actually going on, because we'd have these moments, right, where you're hearing about all these issues on the fronts and whether it was manpower issues or equipment issues. And then I'd be in Kramatorsk or Slovyansk walking around, and there's like hundreds of soldiers there. Or you're in the supermarket and there's just like dozens and dozens of soldiers just like buying bread and Snickers and things like that. And nobody seems super, super concerned. Meanwhile, you're reading stories about how like Slovyansk is about to fall or Kramatorsk. So I don't know. It's a hard thing to wrap your head around, right? When you're hearing super negative things and you're seeing military guys that aren't super panicky or super concerned, but you're also seeing, so yeah, it's something that I have trouble gauging as well. You know, I don't want to make it seem like I have completely accurate ideas of what's going on. And my conclusions are like the best and the most thorough. It's even while you're there, it's a hard thing to understand.
Yeah, man. And I think you're right as well. There's a sense of, like I was doing it, there's a sense of, even when you're there, the disparity with every war, like, you know, like you know what it's like. You'll be at a frontline 1 minute and then you go to the next part and some lads are just playing PlayStation or whatever. But like, I, you know, like, for example, the day we went to Kiev and you know, someone at home was like, oh man, you in Kiev, what the fuck? And I was like, no, man, like Kiev's completely fine. Like it's chill now. And then my friend was like, well, I just looked on the news, like, and like the day I arrived, you know, Russia hit a block of flats with a rocket right in Kiev. He's like, they just hit a block of flats with a rocket. And I was like, yeah, but it's fine. So it's like, well, that's quite a big deal in one way. You know what I mean? And it's like, but yeah. But at the same time, like, yeah, life goes on. It's fine. Like, you know, we went, had dinner there that week, you know? So it's like, it's a tricky one. I get what you're saying. But I do think that, I don't know. You tell me what you think of this. I do worry now that like, it does feel a little bit to me like the media has gotten slightly bored. You know what I'm saying? Like of the thing. I don't know. What do you think? Do you think that's happening now?
I think that happens to a degree. I just want to say too, that Jake did buy me dinner in Kiev. Class yes. act all around.
Come on, man. We got to look after the bros, man.
But yeah, just going back to what you said before, you know, I had this night in Kiev when I first got there. I think one of the first nights I was there and sirens go off, whatever. Most people don't care at this point, but I heard these booms and I looked out the window and people are just like, going about their day. No one really seemed to change anything. So I thought nothing of it. And the next day we found out that was the day the journalist got killed in her apartment.
Right. That was it. Yeah.
You know? Yeah. So it's kind of just like, you know, wrapping your head around stuff like that in a war zone is always tough. And the fog of war is very real. It's not just about, you know, statements coming out. It's about what's actually happening there as well. But yeah, you know, I think there's always a danger when these situations continue, especially when they not stalemate, but when they slow down and there's not big news every day, that I think people start to lose interest and the media reflects that as well. But, you know, the media I kind of hate using the term the media sometimes, right? Because you have cable news and punditry and all that, and they might move on. But I know for a fact, you know, the AFP guys are still in the same hotel, I think, that we were in Kramatorsk, and they're out there shooting every single day. They just had this crazy footage of a woman who's like, I think her hand was bleeding or mangled from shelling. You know, the New York Times guys are there, the Wall Street Journal people are there, the Washington Post people are there. The journalists are still there doing the work. It's just, I think the attention of the public and the attention of other parts of the media, the not sort of on the ground reporter is fading. And that's just, it's unfortunate, but that's kind of, I think, what happens a lot with wars as well. I mean, look at Afghanistan, right? How many stories have you seen about Afghanistan recently?
No, I know. I mean, I get that. Like, yeah, don't get me wrong. Like, fucking loads of reporters still out there doing great work. You know, I'm speaking to loads of them every day. That's for, like, often, like, a lot of it is other reporters reading it and people that are, like, genuinely interested in the conflict and have the time. But when I say the media, it's like my grandma. What she watches, the news every day. You know, even she was like, oh, what's happening in Ukraine now? Like, I didn't see, you know, there's updates, but it's just stand-ups. You know, there's not like packages like there was before. It's just like a guy on a fucking hotel balcony in Lviv still, you know, on the main kind of news. So 100%. that is a worry because it's like, nah, man, these stories need to be getting out there to everybody. You know what I'm saying?
And that's a concern. I mean, that's, you know, they're practical things of dealing with as a freelancer too. I mean, the guys who were there the first month and a half, it was like every day they had a new story that people were up to, wanted, you know, it was just like an update of the situation. And then 3 months in, you can't just do that, right? You need to have an angle. It needs to be different. It needs to be something like that. And that's just how it works. And it's like you said, I think big TV news too is slowing down with it. And that's a big fear among Ukrainians, You know, they are like, we sense the media leaving, or, you know, not just leaving, but we sense people not paying attention as much. And it's really concerning for them, because if that starts to happen, support starts to lessen. And, you know, they're still dealing with this war. And even if the war ended tomorrow, they'd still be dealing with the consequences and having to rebuild everything and all the trauma that has been inflicted on people. So it's definitely, yeah, I mean, it's a hard thing. How do you keep that attention going?
Yeah, it's do you know what? It's nothing to do with reporters. It's nothing to do with the war. It's to do with the industry, and it's to do with the attention economy, which is another story entirely. And it's very sad, actually. Yeah, it's like Johnny Depp and Amber Heard got some kind of defamation case, and like everyone's like, oh yeah, forget the war now. It's like, fuck, man, it's sad. But yeah, when you were out there with Neil, right, Neil Howard, he had a really good point that I was reading on Twitter, where he was saying like he was speaking to a guy that was kind of, you know, kind of pissed off, and like not fuck, but like, you know, he's annoyed with like Zelensky and them guys. And I think the quote was something like, you know, those lot in the city with all the money or whatever. Meanwhile, we're here on the front and we don't have what we need. Sort of what's going on? Did you encounter any kind of sentiment like that?
Yeah, you know, I think there's a couple interesting things there that I was also thinking about myself related to that, you know, because it's weird. You have these moments, you know, you're out east and everything is like chaos and violence and like and bad, right? There's explosions all the time. Mm. There's no real shortages yet, but there's people in some of these villages, I guess, that are living without heat, without food, without all that sort of stuff. Slovyansk, Kramatorsk were okay. So you're there in these situations, and a lot of the soldiers are from the West too. You know, I met a lot of guys from Lviv, a lot of guys from Kiev, volunteers too, that were out there fighting in the West. But there is this huge difference because you're in Kiev now and the bars are open, the cafes are open, yeah. Right? And it's this weird thing that I have trouble because I see two contradicting things, right? On the one hand, it's good. It's good that people can live their normal lives in Kiev. Absolutely. And that's good for the country. It's good for the economy. It's good for the morale. It's good for all that. But I can definitely see people who are out there, these soldiers fighting this war, that are going to get frustrated about people out there having a good time. You know, it's a weird thing. It's kind of like, you know, in the early days of Iraq and Afghanistan, you had the whole American veteran things, like we're fighting for your freedom and all that. And there were also articles later on about how Americans aren't feeling the effect of the war at all, unless they know people in the military, because they're, you know, they're not affected by it. And it's kind of like looking at that.
That's a great point. Yeah.
Through that prism in Kiev, which is like, you know, these guys really are fighting for their freedom to do what they're doing in Kiev. You know, so I think I don't know. Maybe there's an appreciation for like maybe these guys out there in Kiev are in the trenches, being like, I mean, in Kiev, I'm sorry, out in the east, are like, we're doing this so that people can keep living this life in Kiev. You know, because a part of it, when you really look at, I met a lot of the volunteers, a lot of the fighters that were kind of galvanized by Maidan, right? And I don't know. Have you seen Winter on Fire?
Yeah. I have quite a lot of issues with it, to be honest.
I mean, it wasn't the best made film, but I think it kind of captures this way of looking at things during that time that I heard from a lot of the people that were veterans of Maidan and that had fought in the East 2004, 2015, which was like, they really were fighting for their future there. You know, they didn't want to, a big part of it was they didn't want to go towards Russia in that way, right? They looked at that way of life. They looked at the economies there and they wanted to go towards Europe, right? They wanted to go towards the West because they saw that as a better future for themselves, you know? So I'm wondering how that translates to fighting in the East for these guys that are in the trenches, like literally in the trenches. Like, do they look at what they're doing? And I'm sure they do, as fighting for a better future. So they see what's happening in Kiev. Maybe they get on leave or whatever else. And they're like, this is what we're fighting for, right? To keep up this life, to have this going on. But it's a weird thing to parse. You know, I'd see these guys in camouflage in Kiev, guys who look like they had just gotten back. And I'm like, what is running through their head?
Yeah.
And there's definitely that level. I think you're not going to hear it from everyone. And I think it's another common thing. Like I spoke to some guys afterwards that were our Marine vets and things like that. And they're like, look, everyone on the ground, everyone who's a grunt, everyone who's in the trenches is always going to complain that not enough is being done for them, that they feel neglected. And I think in Ukraine as well, it goes back to the feelings between the West and the East as well. You know, there's a history there. So they might have feelings already of feeling somewhat neglected as well. So I think, again, it's definitely, I think, a feeling that is there, that they feel somewhat frustrated. But I heard way more frustration with with the West and with the US in terms of like weapons deliveries and things like that. At the same time, they're very thankful for what's being done and they're grateful for their support, right? There's no animosity there. It's just like, we need more. If they want us to hold this off, if they want us to win, they have to do more for us, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah, I know what you mean. I mean, for me, it's like, I think everyone fighting, it's just unbelievable bravery you've seen out there doing the best they can. Obviously, I was with some of the lads, the Hoods clan lads, and they were like desperate to go to the East because they were like, look, there's no more fighting here. We don't want to be here on guard duty. We want to be fucking fighting, like desperate to go, you know? And it was like very interesting. So I think for me, my point is not that like, oh, the government isn't doing enough. I mean, maybe they're not, but it was just like, I don't know. I just started to get this sense from a few people as well that are like, I don't know. It's like... Where is everything, you know? Like, I don't know. And I guess that's just the fog of war. But I know some volunteers that are on the front that are turning up to units that, like, one unit had, like, two guns between, like, four guys. And they were kind of like, what the fuck is going on, you know? So, and then the unit down the road is, like, one of the best supplied in the area. So I don't know if it's just confusion or what. Like, I don't know. Did you come across anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely feelings sometimes, I think, of neglect and, like, what's happening with all the stuff that's coming in. But it was also more about like, you know, they needed, this is the early days too. There was such, I think, pandemonium. So like, people need vests, they need thermobaric goggles, yeah, and things like that. So you have these heavy weapons coming in, but where's the rest of that stuff? And that's where a lot of the supply chains and stuff are coming from, volunteers and donations and things like that. So yeah, there's definitely levels of frustration. You know, that's what's going to happen, I think, when you're fighting a war and you feel under-resourced versus an enemy that has so much more stuff. So there's definitely some hints of that there. And I think it's going to be interesting to watch and see if that frustration grows and how it affects morale. But there's still, you know, that overnight we were at, I assumed everyone who wanted to sign up had already signed up, but they were saying the next day they had eight guys coming who just, you know, just volunteered, who are just willing to sign a contract. So I think, and you hear too, that manpower isn't the problem right now, right? So the morale is still there, but you're right in that people are getting concerned and frustrated sometimes by what they see as, you know, ineffective supply chains, logistics that aren't there, and just not having the equipment that they need and wondering what's happening to it. But yeah, I mean, your doc is coming out tonight, right? You've got this big doc that
yeah, it's 30 minutes long. It's a 4K. We managed to, you know, we're putting out a 4K quality doc. I think, you know, I think it's just going to show a very different side to things. But I think spending the time I spent with the Hoods clan lads, like, very, they're like the kind of, you know, they're like archetypal, well, not archetypal because they're kind of different politically, whatever. But, you know, very normal lads, mostly Kiev lads, very tough guys, grew up having these crazy, insane football hooligan fist fights with all the fascist groups. They were the only football hooligan firm in the whole of Ukraine to come out and say, we're anti-fascists, we don't like you Nazi guys. And so they became a target for everybody, you know, and the fascinating thing is that they were actually, because you see it in the doc, they're such close friends and such tough guys that they actually became one of the best football hooligan firms. Like, despite that, I found this like link on a forum, like a really old Ultras forum, where these fascists are like, oh, you get banned if you even mention Hoods clan, because they were so embarrassed that they'd been beaten up by anti-fascists, you know, like, it was pretty funny. But I think spending time with them, I realized, I was like, man, you know, these guys are between a rock and a hard place. They're desperate to get to the East. And, you know, they were telling me there's just so much bureaucracy right now for them. And they're like, look, we're ready to go. We're trained. We're training. They train very hard. They're training every day. They're not the ones that are like sitting around taking selfies. You know, they're training very, very hard every day. And it's just, it's a weird one. And then you read a story about like some guy that kind of, you know, signed up to say he's a refugee and got drafted to the front line with no training in one day. And it's like, what the fuck is going on? You know, yeah. So I think for me, it was like, my criticism is not even criticism. It's not like, oh yeah, Ukraine's fucking up. It's like, man, these lads are so brave and tough and fighting for everybody in Ukraine. It's just like, man, what is going on? Like, I think it's just at the point in the war where shit like that just starts happening. You know what I'm saying? Like, things get very confused, things fall apart a little bit. And it's just, I hope that they can kind of pull themselves out of that, because I am hearing quite a lot of stories more and more now about, like, you know, just this group ran out of ammunition, da da da, and it's like, well, there's a lot of money going in, a lot of weapons are being sent in, not enough, but they are being sent, and it's like, what's going on? I don't know. It's just, it's it's a confusing one for me. You know what I'm saying?
The bureaucracy is definitely, I mean, it's definitely crazy, a frustrating thing. I think the first month it was kind of a free for all, right? Because nothing was set up. But yeah, I mean, that's another confusing thing that you hear, right? Because I know plenty of people that, you know, I even know a US vet who has military experience, but not combat experience, that's been desperate to get to the front line too. And he was saying like, they're not letting people go unless they really can do it. But then you hear other stories of people that have been sent there without much. So it's kind of, that's another one of those things that's hard to wrap your head around, right? Like what is, it's in all likelihood, it's both, you know, like there are people that are getting sent out there, maybe that don't have a ton of training. And there's other people that have the training that can't get out there because it really is just a bureaucracy thing and a confusion thing, you know, and the fronts are crazy and they're changing every day. But yeah, I mean, I think the Hoods Clan thing, I think fascinates me because you know, the stories that I want to do always are these stories of these guys that remind me of like me and my friends.
Exactly.
Or just the lads, you know, and they're put in a impossible situation, not because of the things happening around them. And it's kind of like, well, this could be me and my boys, you know, or my friends from college, my friends from high school, whatever, if we were born here. Like this would be us right now. And obviously, you know, I don't think we'd be a fucking crazy ultra, you know, soccer hooligan gang that beat the fuck out of people all the time. But I'm saying
not tough
like,
enough for that.
Yeah, no, definitely I'm not on that level. But I mean like, you know, just like dudes who would rather be playing fucking video games or at the bar with their friends, hitting on girls. And that's like, that's a big part of what a lot of wars are, you know, and getting to spend time with a group like that, which is why I'm really looking forward to your doc. And I think it's going to be great. And just having them show that sort of humanity that I think that everyone has, of them just like busting balls with their friends, where people can watch and be like, whoa, this reminds me of like me and my friends sitting around at the bar being idiots, except these guys have to fight the Russian army right now. You know, I did that story in Syria years ago about the rebel kids that I knew, and that's I had this like lightning, I can't fucking speak English right now, this light bulb moment where I was like, whoa, like these guys are just like me. I mean, obviously there's differences in culture and things like that, but like, you know, and that's always a story that I look to do. And you see that, you know, you have a number of stories here in the newspapers with all that about like, you know, this guy was a baker a week and a half ago. This guy was a mechanic, but a lot of that is quick, you know, and it just gives sort of the basics and then gives a couple lines. Cause that's just the nature of daily news of, you know, a couple lines of like, we have to fight. I just want to get back to my life, blah, 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 that sort of stuff. Anytime someone has an opportunity to dig deeper like you have, I get really excited about it. But it's another thing too that I think people need to realize, you know, anytime I had these interviews with guys that went a little long, I like to ask, you know, what do they want to do after the war? And what they always look at me like I'm crazy, right? And they're just like, I just want to go back to, you know, like back to my mechanic shop or back to being an advertising executive. Like the Ukrainians are literally fighting just so they can go back to living their normal life afterwards.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
that's their only intention. And I mean, there's other people too, like this couple that were lawyers. They're in a couple articles actually. They get some good press on themselves. You know, they are working on their PhDs in criminology. They want to get out, and their number one, they're like, after we deal with the Russians, we're going to deal with the corruption. You know, like they don't want to stop after the war. They really want to build this country into something that I think they can all be proud of. I mean, not they all can be proud of, they are proud of, but you know what I'm saying? They really want to build a future for Ukraine. And I think that's such a big motivation from a lot of the people that I spoke to. You know, it's not like, like they really have looked at the last 30 years and seen the progress that the country has made or has been making, especially up their Maidan. And they're like, we want this country to have a future. And there really is, I mean, dude, you've been there. Like there's so much there that could be pretty special. I mean, and even like, the tech industry stuff, the graphic design, all that, you know, Ukrainians now are getting famous for tech stuff and all that. Like there's, you know, they want to succeed. They want the country to do well, and they want to make changes. Like if this war wasn't happening, they'd be after their own politicians to make changes too. You know, like that motivation is there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, definitely. I mean, I don't really want to go into it too much because Zelensky is putting up a very good, you know, he's doing a very good job of being a wartime leader. But before the war, a lot of people were getting quite annoyed with him. He was in the Panama Papers. There was corruption. He was becoming very coming down hard on the press, actually restricting press freedoms quite a lot. I think he sent a group in to raid the Kiev Post because they wrote an article that he didn't like, you know, so things like that. And it's like, yeah, that is very true. Like, this fucking nonsense from the Russians, like, yeah, everyone's a Nazi, they want a Nazi junta. It's like, nah, man, they want the cleanest country. They want their country to be doing well. Like, that's all it is. It's like a fight for survival to just go back to normal and build the best country they can have. Like, it's very simple in that sense, you know what I mean? It's fascinating as well. Like, like you said, you know, we were speaking to the lads with Hoodswood's clan, and I was like, oh, you know, what do you miss? And they were like, just hanging out. Like, but all of them, because they're all together still, quite a few of them said, yeah, okay, we are hanging out here, but this isn't, you know, this isn't how we're meant to be hanging out. We're not meant to be like learning how to fire an RPG. It's like, we're meant to be hanging out, you know, having fun and enjoying life. You know, it's really fucking sad in that regard. But I think, you know, I don't know, the people will keep going no matter what. Going back to the Donbass, what is it you think people like need the most out there? Is there food shortages still? Obviously, there's ammunition shortages. Like, what did you notice the most?
No, I mean, there was food there, you know, the supermarkets had food, things like that. It's not great, but there's still food there. There's still water in those big cities. I think it's going to get tougher. Fuel was tough, but you could always get it. You know, it's just a pain in the ass. No, they need heavy artillery, man. Like, without that, you know, the Russians have them beat range wise. So there's nothing they can do sometimes. Any level of air combat they could be, or air defense they could have, I should say, would be, I think, super beneficial. But it's like they need heavy duty advanced artillery so that they can compete, and they need the ammunition to go with it, because they're just getting, you know, the new Russian tactic that they changed to after those rapid advances were shut off is just obliterating places, right? Just leveling them and then slowly moving in. But to do that first is just like them just shooting the shit out of every area. And if the Ukrainians can't defend against that, or can't duel back with their artillery, you know, they're going to get smoked and these cities are going to get destroyed.
Yeah. Do you think, I mean, at the start, you know, Russia came up with so much bullshit. It was like, oh, it's this, it's that, it's Nazis, it's NATO, it's rare. Well, we want to free the Ukrainians. We want to liberate the area. Now, I mean, last week or this week, Putin literally just was like, yeah, no, they're a colony. We want to conquer them and take them back. Like, full mask off. Clearly everything he said before was bullshit, you know, mask off imperialism there, which must be hilarious for like the kind of red fascist types, you know what I mean? It must be very, very struggle for them to kind of justify Putin being like, no, we want to take them back. You know, they're a colony. But do you think now it's just Russia has just gone, right, just destroy everything? Because before, you know, they take over a city, they put up some fake like pro-Russian group in there. I think we're seeing it in we're seeing it in Mariupol right now. They've painted the Ukrainian signs with Russian flag colors. So, you know, clearly it's, you know, it's some level of like, oh yeah, this is now Russia. But it seems to me that they've changed tactics to like, yeah, just destroy everything basically in the east. Or I don't know. What do you think?
Well, yeah, I mean, they did destroy a lot of Mariupol. You know, I've seen estimates. True. Who knows if those estimates are right? But you're right. I mean, in the beginning, you know, it didn't seem, there was definitely destruction, but I think they thought they would just advance so quickly and take over these areas so quickly without that much resistance. And they obviously gambled completely wrong, and it was a terrible strategy. Now I think it's just leveling areas and moving forward. Like that's what they're aiming to do. And you know, those statements about the colony stuff and whatever else, those aren't new. I mean, Putin has let that mask down a couple of times, I think, over the past couple of months. Yeah. But if you look at other Russian politicians, Russian TV channels, the news channels, like they're pretty open about that. You know, they're pretty open about Ukraine not being a real country, about how they should be in charge, about like stamping out Ukrainian culture and things like that. Like it's pretty above and beyond in terms of making that explicitly clear in terms of what they want to do or what they sought to do. At least, you know, definitely on those news channels, the politicians as well. Like it's been mask off. You know, that was never. That was always the intention.
That's really true, actually. There's quite a hilarious disparity between the kind of bizarre, like, tanky pro-Russians on Twitter versus, like, what the actual Kremlin is saying. It's like, bro, like, they're saying it. They're saying it. Like, the thing that you're saying, no, they're not doing this. They're like, no, they're saying that's what they're doing. That's quite funny, actually, when you think about it. Danny, you had this amazing story about the... Well, it's amazing, but it's extremely sad and brutal. About, you know, the family that were captured by the Russians. Talk to us about that. Like, what happened there?
Yeah. You know, I've done this for many years, and I rarely get, I think, worked up during interviews anymore, or even like even reading the first page of that story now, like, gets me a little flushed, you know? So it's a story I did for Vanity Fair. I actually got it. The way I got the story was because, a woman I know who works for Doctors Without Borders, who I'd met in Iraq like 10 years ago, was in town. And we just got coffee with one of her colleagues who's Ukrainian. They were kind of, you know, I was asking them how it was going, blah, blah, blah. They started telling me about one of the women they worked with. And I was like, I have to go do the story if you guys could put me in contact with her. So they really helped me out there. She's working with them now. So the woman, Olena, she is a doctor, you know, and her husband was actually fought in Afghanistan. Like, he was in the Soviet military, and then he became a police officer, but he was retired. And they live in Hostomel, which is next to Bucha and Irpin, you know, those sort of satellite suburbs.
Yeah, outskirts of Kiev, right?
Right. That are famous now, or infamous for the war crimes that were done to the people there by the Russians. And they had like the perfect life. You know, they were like, he was mostly retired. You know, they had a nice house. The kids all have their own places and are working or whatever else, or in school. And, you know, they live in this like lovely suburb where, you know, people go bike riding and they say hello to you as you're walking your dog and everything like that. You know, they have barbecues in the backyard. They had a nice garden, all that. So they're living the Ukrainian version of the suburban dream, but they're living in Hostomel. And that's where that airport is, that the Russians try to land a lot of forces to take over Kiev. And there are battles back and forth and helicopters, all that sort of stuff. So they wake up February 24th and there's just booms and all sorts of just chaos going on as they're fighting over this airport, as the Ukrainians and the Russians are shooting back over each other. And they're just like completely, they don't know what's going on. And that goes on for like a week, right? As artillery, you know, they're looking, they can see people firing at each other from the hills nearby, everything over the airport, and shells are landing, people are getting hurt, people are dying, people are trying to escape, they get closed off eventually. And she essentially turns her house, and they made some house calls as well, and the basement of a nearby apartment complex into like a one woman clinic. You know, at first they were driving an ambulance they commandeered around, but it was too unsafe to do that. So she basically started treating people in her house because she's a doctor, you know, like dealing with shrapnel, dealing with wounds. People were getting sick. It was the dead of winter, PTSD type stuff, all that sort of stuff. She basically becomes this one woman clinic. And it's occupied, right? Hostomel gets occupied by the Russians, but for the most part, you know, it's just explosions and gunfire and all that. They're not seeing them until maybe 2 or 3 weeks into it, Russians show up. At first, there's like one or two groups that come and they're just asking, you know, for cell phones, blah, blah, blah. It's fine. And then I think the third group that comes the third day in a row shoots the husband in the knee and in the hip, grabs them, yokes them up, takes them prisoner. So it's the husband, his wife, Olena, the doctor, and their son, who's like 22. And they bring them to sort of the Russian de facto bases that they have. You know, they're hooded the entire time. They basically torture the woman a little bit to try to figure out, they're like, what does your husband know? Who is he talking to? Is he calling coordinates? All this other stuff. They hold her for 2 days. And they kind of figure out that she's like this only doctor. So they let her go, you know, but they don't let her husband and her son go. They keep them locked up. Eventually, they transport them to Belarus, where they're at a filtration camp. And the son, you know, the husband he's a tough guy. You know, he was a commando in Afghanistan for 2 years, 82, 84, with like the Soviet forces. You know, that guy can withstand anything. I don't think he can break. Like, I don't think it's possible for him to break. But the son is like a 22-year-old kid. He's like a tough kid. Like, he's a wrestler. But the way they describe him after those first couple of weeks, it was just like completely shell-shocked. You know, just like having a really hard time, hard go of it. Give me a second. I'm going to get a drink of water.
Hello?
So, sorry. I was going to drink of water.
Sorry.
So they take them to this filtration camp. The husband, they eventually put him with a bunch of soldiers and some other people, and they take them to prison in Russia. So he ends up in Kursk. I can never say it. Kursk, in a prison there. Yeah. They hold him for a month. You know, they beat a prisoner to death in front of him. These guys are held in a cell. They don't see the sunlight for weeks and weeks and weeks. You know, it's an altogether awful situation. It's a Russian prison, you know, like the movies about that are sort of accurate. Eventually, he's released in exchange. They you know, he goes all over. He's in Donetsk. He ends up in Crimea, all that. He gets free. They take him in a bus. They meet at like a bridge. The captured Russian soldiers walk one way. The captured Ukrainian soldiers and civilians walk the other way. They get freed. So he's let go. And he meets his wife back, you know, the whole time. The wife had no idea, like no idea where they were or what happened. She has this moment where she talks about how, you know, bodies were turning up after Bucha was liberated. I think those areas were liberated April 1st, April 2nd. He's not free to April 18th. She has no idea what happened. So every time a body is turns up, she goes there and she's looking to see if it's her son or her husband. So she said, like, this is a quote, "I saw all the dead bodies in Bucha and Irpin." And if you look up what happened in there,
so she's, they were just like, to see.
Like, yeah. Yeah. And she's at that point, she's working with MSF. So she's helping treat people and all that. So she has no idea until she gets a phone call that her husband's about to be freed. So he gets freed. They go see her, but the son is still missing. And the last he was seen was in Belarus. And there, you know, the husband's connected a little bit. He's a retired cop. He knows. So they're calling everyone they can. She's calling everyone she can, and they still have no information on him. And that's just how the story ends. They're just desperately trying to figure out where he is. She's refusing to tell her mother, the kid's grandmother, what happened or that he's missing still, because she doesn't think she can handle it because her heart's bad. It's just this story of them trying to figure it out. And there's all sorts of crazy little side tangents that were included. Like there's apparently a network of ex-prisoners in Ukraine that are connected to ex-prisoners in Russia. I mean, some of them have served time together, whatever. And they're trying to get the prisoners in Ukraine or the ex-prisoners to talk to the prisoners in Russia, which they have, to see if they can figure anything out. Like, who's in the prisons? Are there Ukrainians there? What are their names? Stuff like that. There's all sorts of stuff being done to try to figure out where this kid is. But for right now, like, they have no idea where their son is. And they have no information on it whatsoever.
Jesus Christ. So the last I heard, he was in a fucking concentration camp, basically, in Belarus.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was probably, I think, March 25th, 26th, sometime around then.
Shit is unbelievable, man. When you hear stories like that, and then some other fucker turns up and is like, "What about NATO?" Like, yeah, I fucking think NATO is full of shit, like, whatever. But, like, what the fuck has that got to do with this family and their fucking kid being put into a concentration camp and, like, the husband being shot in his leg for what? For, like, just being alive in Ukraine? Like, what the fuck, bro? It's so sad.
Yeah, it's really, I mean, I spoke to them for hours and hours at their house. You know, they made me food. It's dark, man. Like, they're just, they keep a plate setting for him at the house, just waiting for him to come back.
That is so sad. Have you had any updates?
I checked in maybe like a week or two ago with the woman who works at MSF, who's like my contact, and nothing yet.
Man, that's dark. All right, Danny, is there anything else you want to talk about before we go?
No, I don't know, man. It's I don't think people should lose attention to this, you know, and definitely, you know, I think that's the main thing that people have to realize. Like, Ukrainians are simply fighting just to go back to their normal lives. You know, that's what this war is about when it comes down to it. They just want to live, you know, and they don't want to live under the thumb of Russia. And the stuff that happened in like Bucha and Irpin, these war crimes, look, you know, stuff gets broadcast sometimes and there are some outrageous claims made about war crimes, stuff like this. I don't run with everything that gets put up there on Twitter or whatever else it is, right? You gotta vet stuff. But these war crimes were committed in Bucha and Irpin in Hostomel. Like, I've looked these people in the face and spoke to them about it. Like, their relatives are missing. People were tortured. People were executed with their hands behind their back.
Yeah, like, these
yeah, these things are being done right now. So, and who knows what's been happening in Mariupol and Kherson in these other areas. Like, it's dark and these things are real. They're real things that are happening. They're not internet debates for people to get mad at each other on Twitter to make it fit into their narrative. You know, these people are, I mean, that's the kind of thing that the frustrated soldier was saying outside the coffee shop. He was like, "Look, these are debates to you guys, but every day you spend debating, like, my friends are dying."
Yeah. Yeah.
And he was referring to the debates about the weapons.
Weapons.
So yeah, I mean, I don't know, man. Besides that, sorry to end on such a dire note, but I guess it's Popular Front, right? Doesn't, not that many happy endings for this podcast.
No one's coming in to be cheered up, lad. Don't worry about that. But it's reality, you know. This is, I really hate this fucking, like there's like a form of violence in like enforced positivity, like good vibes only. Like, no, not good vibes only, because you need to know about what the fuck is happening in places like Ukraine and in places like that, you know? So yeah, no, don't worry about that at all.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think definitely people who aren't there should, you know, enjoy themselves at times, but like,
no, they should be miserable all the time, actually. No, you know what I mean though. It's just, you know, at least be aware, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, dude, I'm looking forward to your doc. Definitely. I think hopefully it gets uploaded and I can watch it tomorrow morning.
Yeah,
I think it's going to be
when I'm 40 this fucking race.
Yeah, I think it's going to be cool. I should have one more story coming out in Rolling Stone Digital, but also, you know, I did a couple podcast episodes. I do paid the Underworld podcast, which is about organized crime. We've had Jake on actually, I think once or twice, maybe we'll do that again soon. And we threw some Ukraine stuff, cause I was there for 6 weeks. So we threw some Ukraine stuff there in I think two of the most recent episodes where we talked about it. But yeah, DannyGoldJournalist.com. I don't think any of my Ukraine stuff is up, but that's my other work. And I think we did an episode when? Like one of your first 10 episodes?
Yeah, it was like one of the first ones, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. What was it? Was it MS-13? It was something like that.
Yeah,
but, yeah, man, happy to be back and psyched to see your work when it comes out. And also, yeah, if you're another podcaster, I'd love to talk more about Ukraine and also promote the hell out of the Underworld podcast, because we need more listeners and more Patreon subscribers, man. I'm trying to eat.
No, definitely. I mean, I always tell people, like, you know, if you like Popular Front and you like true crime, then go and listen to Underworld podcast. Like,
no, we get a lot. I mean, I have people all the time tell me that they found out about us from you. So hopefully, even more, we'll find out now. But thanks as always for having me on, man. I'm psyched, and it was good to see you in Kiev too. And thanks for the pizza, man.
Yeah, man, definitely 100%. All right, man. Thanks, Danny. Where can people follow you? Sorry, on socials.
Social is but I'm so fucking obnoxious on social media.
Me as well.
DG is serious is my Twitter name. Let me think. The podcast is the Underworld Podcast, patreon.com/Underworld Podcast for interviews and stuff like that. We're everywhere you could find us. I think we have a YouTube channel up where we just put up the audio. There's an Instagram account too. I think that's just the Underworld Podcast as well. Our underworldpod.com is the website where you can find all that stuff and merch and all that stuff. But yeah, that's pretty much it.
All right, man. Thanks very much, Danny. Really appreciate that.
Yeah, dude. Thanks for having me on.
All right, man. Speak soon.
Was Danny Gold speaking about his time in the Donbass recently. Since speaking to Danny, I spoke to some friends in Ukraine. I thought it worth mentioning on this podcast. They were telling me there's some weird stuff going on in the east. There's some kind of corruption. Oil is being stolen and sold off by various corrupt people within the Ukraine side. Sounds like a bad situation. Not soldiers, they're not doing it, but some people are doing it down there. So yeah, bad situation. And this is Ukraine fighters that are telling me this, telling me like, yeah, this is bad, mate, like, blah, blah. So worth really focusing on that region, especially now as things slip out of the news. Definitely follow Danny Gold on socials. Look up his podcast, the Underworld Podcast, as we just mentioned. It's really cool. You'll definitely like it. If you like what we're doing here at Popular Front, please do consider supporting us on the Patreon, patreon.com/popularfront. That is the main way we make our money. That helps us keep moving forward. Unfortunately, there is a lot of hurdles for us to make money. For example, we just put a brand new documentary out on YouTube, Frontline Hooligan. You've probably heard of it by now. It is a documentary where we spent time with Ukraine's only anti-fascist football hooligan firm that are now fighting Russia on the front lines. We put that documentary out and YouTube immediately age restricted it, so a lot less people will see it. It's completely demonetized. Our whole channel is completely demonetized, essentially. And they also removed the thanks button. So even if someone wanted to comment and give us like a fiver and say, yeah, good work, they've actually removed that now. So it's fucked up. So the way we can continue to keep moving forward is the Patreon, patreon.com/popularfront. There is loads of bonus content there, video content, audio, all sorts, lots of stuff there. Or if you want to send us a one-time donation or something like that, go to popularfront.co/support. As I said, unfortunately, a lot of the main avenues for us to make money have been completely shut down because a lot of these big tech companies only allow advertising on very namby-pamby soft content. We don't do that at Popular Front. We do real life shit. So they've stopped us from making any money from it. It's annoying. It's a struggle, but we're not going to change what we do. Fuck that. Thank you to our sponsors on the podcast. They are Oracle Coffee Shop in Portland, Oregon, USA. They're an independent coffee business selling only fair trade products. See them at 3875 Southwest Bond Avenue, 97239. They are also Grind Core House, a pair of independent coffee shops in Philadelphia, USA, one in South, one in West. Find them on socials at Grind Core House. We're also sponsored by Propagandopolis, an outlet selling and writing about historical conflict propaganda from around the world. You can buy prints at propagandopolis.com. Use the promo code PopularFront10 for 10% off. The lad that runs Propagandopolis is actually a friend of ours. We share an office with him. He's just had a baby, so congrats, lad. Really happy to hear everything went well. If you want to follow us on the social medias, Instagram at popular.front, Twitter at popularfront_, and you can follow me anywhere at Jake_Hanrahan, HANRAHAN. The YouTube.com/popularfront. As I said, you'll see our new documentary there, Frontline Hooligan. If you can, please do share it, because YouTube is trying to give us this soft censorship. Instagram is doing the same. I guess the narrative of anti-fascist football hooligans fighting in the war, talking about the neo-Nazis they previously fought, I guess that doesn't really tee up with the agenda for a lot of these tech bros and what have you. Either that, or they just were like, yeah, fuck them. The algorithm said no. I don't know, but it's a fucking pain. But still, it's done like 60,000 views in 3 days, despite being age restricted, which anyone who knows about YouTube will know that an age restriction absolutely torpedoes your views. But it is what it is. You can also find it, the doc, in a much lower quality on the Telegram. I think that's t.me/onlypopularfront. There'll be no age restrictions there, but again, it's not the same watching it on a phone, you know. Yeah, if you can, get hold of a YouTube account, watch it, share it, whatever. We know a lad that messaged Sam Black, and he was like, I'm in an Indonesian prison, and he was watching it. So if you can find a way, someone can find a way, yeah, definitely check it out. Music in this episode, the intro was by Home, and the outro, as always, was by Sam Black. Sam Black's music is now slowly being uploaded to all music streaming platforms, also on all social medias. Yeah, if you go to samblackpf.com, you'll see his music, but you can search for it also on Spotify, Apple Music, all of them, Deezer, all of those ones, all the weird ones. Just search for Sam Black PF. We're trying to upload kind of a lot of back catalogs up there, but Ditto and Spotify and all them just take a long time. It's a pain. But yeah, if you just keep checking back in, follow him on there on the Spotify, and it will keep notifying every time a new EP or whatever a track is up on there. Yeah, as I said before, please consider supporting us at patreon.com/popularfront. Thank you very much to the higher tier Patreons. They are Claire Hofbauer, Benjamin Topper, Chongus Bongwater, Cameron Collins, Nutty, Q Loves Cake Farts, Nicholas Blomberg, Matthew Diffley, Noah Schmidt, Jane Millerchip, Claire, Liana, Sean Krishanovich, NTHG, Ethan Zwick, Champagne Anarchist, Elise Middlefart, David McManus, Joaquin Williamson Holt, Yudoye Travis, Hector K, Tom Petrie, James Leons, Lisa Milgram, Bradley Davies, No Dogs, No Hamsters, Brendan Crave, B, Drift, Pete Hesher, RX, Tiki Lover, Cherry, Ben Marshall, Dallas Dunn, Sikhar Gupta, LD50 Seattle, K Glitter Vulcan, Meredith Waters, Bethany Swoveland, Adam H, Ryan Barber Dillo, Derivative Fool, and then someone's name is Bo Lo Wo Wa, which is the way Brits like me say bottle of water. Bottle of water. Larson 8669, Karante, Bjorn Kirsten, Diamond Steen, Michael O'Connor, Jack Doherty, Nicholas Butter, JD, Jav, Ian Fruis, James Cully, Anil Dingus, Tynan Daly, Ethan, Shanklin the Painter, Fitz Madrid, Ed Coulthard, Mike Barone, Ben, Scott Hopton, Liam Williams, Chris Cusimano, Degenerate Zero Alpha, Giorgio Arani, DR, Trey Nance, Amy R, Rubicon, Frank Austin, Amelia Mee, Nawaiz, Nate Van Dor, Christina Rivetti, Freya Northman, Noah, Andrew Hurley, Vida Provost, Brian McLaughlin, Tom Lochrin, Young Wasabi, Tony Bin, Adam Bergsnyder, JL, Stephen Davila, Dan Dunham, Fletcher, Chad Walker, Diana Govanek, Lawrence Abrahams, What Bitcoin Did with Peter McCormick, Christopher Martin, Ryan Sandercock, and Moritz Zumbul. Thank you all so much. Really do appreciate it, especially in times like this where YouTube is just trying to fuck us, basically. Like, we I don't know, man. Like, it's just ridiculous. Taking away the thanks thing is just like, ugh. Like, people can't even donate their own money for the doc's sake of it, you know? Nightmare. Anyway, thank you all for supporting. Support us, patreon.com/popularfront.